This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com. And now we turn to Pat Riley from the University of California, Irvine. Pat studies the entertainment industry, comedy in particular. He published The Layers of a Clown, Career Development in Cultural Production Industries in the Academy of Management Discoveries. And you also have a podcast, right, Pat?
Yes, I do. It's called WTF with Mark Maron. I play a 50-year-old stand-up comedian that doesn't like going to the post office and has a lot of cats. So going pretty good.
Seriously, what is the name of your podcast? Can you tell us a little bit about it?
It's called The Goods from the Woods. So it's basically kind of an outgrowth of my comedy research, my ethnographic research, and it's with a couple of stand-up comedians. And we bring on a number of comics from the local scene. You know, we've had some guests who have names, are recognizable, like Trey Crowder, the liberal redneck, was on because he's good friends with the host of the podcast. But we usually have people that are kind of within the open mic or above open mic scene in LA, and we talk about random topics. And then occasionally we might have a deep dive into something completely random, like Garth Brooks, Chris Gaines, alter ego, or World Championship Wrestling in North Korea, which is a thing, which almost blew up into a whole geopolitical crisis when they almost detained Ric Flair. True story. And then we also have kind of some other episodes that are more just kind of a little bit more gimmicky, you know. It's not particularly intellectual, but it's a fun time, and you get to meet some of the wild personalities that is LA open mic stand up comedy.
Are you like the brainiac on the podcast? You're like the brainy guy?
Actually, I'm not. I'm not. It's three know-it-alls, and the one major league know-it-all is my friend Mr. Goodnight, who is the kind of the brains behind the operation. I think his knowledge of the antiquities could challenge or even surpass Gabriel's. So that's actually a testament to how much of a and he does it with a Dusty Rhodes voice.
And he definitely beats me when it comes to knowledge of children's cartoons, which Goodnight's constantly throwing in. But you asked if Pat's the intellectual. His co-host likes to annoy him by calling him Dr. Pat.
So, Dr. Pat, tell us about your I want to just say straight up, I have a serious topic envy. You know, like there's no secondary data set that I can analyze in R, so I'm not going to study the comedy industry. But I want to hear all about it. Tell us about your research.
Sure. I mean, I would, if you could actually lead me in a particular direction.
Oh, yeah.
There's so many directions I can go in.
Let's start with the layers of the clown, because that was a nice piece talking about the stand-up comedy business and moving up the ranks and how to establish a career. How do you make it as a comedian?
Well, it's actually very interesting because in stand-up comedy, it's not particularly linear. Like when we think of the development of a career, you think about it in terms of kind of this linear progression. Like if you think about actors and actresses, you think about the sequences of better or worse movie credits. Or even in the 1970s in stand-up comedy, there was a very sort of linear progression where you went to a particular club, you worked through the stable there, you got on Johnny Carson, and then you get your series development deal, and then onward and forward. In stand-up comedy, it's actually very interesting where you kind of start out in – it's not – organized around, say, going to a particular club, but really a lot of the work happens in these kind of cliques that you form with other stand-up comedians that are starting out. It's almost like an effect of the freshman at the lunch table, right?
Yeah. From reading, when Pat and I were talking about it as he was writing it, I was thinking like, oh, this is like how, you know, 15 years after you start grad school, you'll start a podcast with people who were not necessarily your cohort, but in the next cohort over.
Sure. Yeah. And you know, a lot of the development happens because there is a lot of exclusion of newcomers. I mean, it's one of those things where you have to kind of earn your stripes. There's a lot of dues paying. One person in my study basically said that, like, you're basically a non-entity until you're in for 6 months because they presume you're going to like just quit, you know? So one of the things that's kind of interesting is that these kind of cliques are a, as Gabe kind of insinuated through the podcast example, these are an enduring aspect of your career. You will go back to the people that you started out with a lot of times, if they're still doing stand-up comedy, to workshop jokes because they're the people that know you well. And a lot of your sustaining within the stand-up comedy community and this career is predicated upon having this strong clique of people. And so you kind of work from there into the sort of larger domain of the community. And then you work your way, which is, you know, fellow stand-up comedians. And then you work your way up into the industry where you get your paydays. But the thing is that you work your way, not progressively where you kind of graduate from doing, you know, small sets at the Comedy Store at 2 a.m. in front of a bunch of drunk tourists, right? Even if you're Chris Rock, you're still doing that. You're still going into these smaller sorts of venues. So it's more of a thing where it's not necessarily a linear progression where you grow out of a certain thing, but it's really actively part of being a stand-up comedian that you kind of work downwards and work into these smaller venues, different levels of you know, your organization have different purposes in the construction of your bits of ideas, of the execution of ideas. And it's something that is kind of, it doesn't matter if you're, you know, a total jabroni that just started out or somebody like a Chris Rock or Dave Chappelle even. I mean, it's a kind of the way in which careers develop. And it's one of those things that I kind of noticed as I was doing my ethnographic work, my participant observation work among stand-up comedians, that this is a really kind of the way in which their social organization, but also how they kind of create these things and how things get produced.
I have a question. So when, you know, when you see movies where there's a, like Adam Sandler, a popular comedian, and the same, he seems to have the same troupe of actors in all of his movies. Are those basically, if somebody makes it big, you dole out favors to your friends and bring up the group? Is that how that works? Or,
well, all Adam, that's a tough example because all Adam Sandler comedies are the same movie, just with a different title. But I think a better example of that is, and you know, I use pseudonyms in my study, but I don't think that this is controversial. One of the first people I met in my study was Gerard Carmichael. When he was starting out as a stand-up comedian, he was doing open mic. So Gerard Carmichael, who was the creator and the star of the show The Carmichaels, he has a couple of HBO specials. Like, he's the real deal. The people that he started out with when he was starting out with open mics persisted onward throughout his career. And when he was staffing the writers of The Carmichael Show, he brought in a couple of people, Ari Kecher and Willie Hunter, who were people that he started out with. And you could think of it as a favor, but another way in which you can think about it is that when Gerard was coming up with the concepts of the show, he was working them out, these scenarios out with Willie and Ari and his other people that he did stand up with when, you know, when they were waiting for their set times. So they kind of have a really strong chemistry. So when you come into, you know, your first project, like somebody like a Gerard Carmichael, you have those people in there that know who you are, that you kind of vibe with, and you can kind of execute those ideas because they're familiar with who you are, especially if you're a newcomer. But I mean, Amy Schumer does that a lot with, you know, her movies. You know, you see Nikki Glaser and Natasha Leggero and other people like that. So it's like, a lot of times when you look at comics who get big projects, you'll see people that they started out with within the mix.
Did you see parallels between the comedy business and the academic business?
Yes. And I don't think this is imposed by the fact that I'm an academic that was hanging around with stand-up comics and forcing my world upon how I see theirs. There are a lot of similarities, I think, in many aspects of the stuff that I studied. So in my dissertation, I mean, some of the time things that I studied, like, you know, the ways in which people organize each other in that paper that we've been talking about. Also, I had a chapter in my dissertation that talked about quitting, why people stick into it. And I, when I was reading it, I was just like, man, there are a lot of similarities with why people continue in academics, why they continue adjuncting and things like that. When, you know, it kind of seems like the idea of having a really good tenure track job is remote and that maybe they should do something else. I mean, there's a lot of similarities that I saw within.
You got to flesh that out. Why do people stick at it? Like either in our business or theirs?
I think there's a certain like kind of commitment trap involved, right? That there's a certain aspect of it, at least with stand-up comics that I saw, where people, you don't know if you're going to be successful, right? And success is very tough to kind of qualify in stand-up comedy, because there is a sort of thing where you can get on, a Comedy Central special, right? A 30-minute special, and you're making like $15,000 a year. Stardom is not. I mean, people like call. I've heard people call a teacher. If you're a star, you get teacher money, or bartender money. That's like kind of the level of income that you get. But in order to sustain in it, you don't know if you're going to be able to sustain and have a career. I mean, a lot of people say it takes 10 years to figure that sort of thing out. So people kind of progress forward with it, and as they kind of go along at that 10-year point. They realize that they've accrued so many specific social connections, right? So many specific skills. They've kind of been outside of the job market for 10 years trying to pursue stand-up comedy, either not having a job or working a kind of crappy temp job or working as a waiter or something like that, that they kind of stick into it because it's like, well, it becomes almost like a sunk cost fallacy in a way. And I've noticed, I mean, I don't want to paint with a broad brush, but I mean, I'm talking to some of my people I know that were kind of in the later areas of their PhD programs, or people that were kind of adjuncting and lecturing for a long time. I mean, a lot of the language that they talked about with, I mean, this is purely anecdotal. I mean, there was kind of some similarities in the way in which they talked about what they were doing. I mean, some of the comics kind of talked about being in stand-up comedy was like being in prison, right? and that they didn't really enjoy it. And they have this like warped view of the world, and they don't find other people funny anymore. So it's like, so that was one of the things that I kind of got into. But yeah, sometimes, I mean, it is cultural production. Like what we do is kind of a cultural production field. So, I mean, there were some definite similarities, and it's loosely structured in a way. I mean, obviously there's bureaucratic stuff with what we do, but there were some overlaps, kind of scary sometimes.
So Pat, so I had a question, since this is about cultural production, I'm wondering how much of, I think about the places in the U.S. that I think of as being just these hubs, like of where, like, you know, like, are the comics that we think of as our comics are produced, right? So I think about Chicago, I think about LA, I think about New York, I think about Boston, right? So what is it about, because you were focusing primarily on LA, right?
Correct, yes.
So what is it, what is distinct about the comics that come out of LA? Like, is there an LA comic culture?
Well, one of the things that there's almost like kind of two LAs in a way, where a lot of the people that make it big in their respective scenes, like a lot of people that are from DC, or a lot of people that are from Austin, or a lot of people that are from Atlanta, a lot of people, even a lot of people that make it big in New York, come to Los Angeles. And, you know, so in some respects, they have to not totally start over again, but they aren't at the same position as they were in their home cities. So they come in and they go through kind of the process of entrenching themselves. A lot of the things with LA is that a lot of the comics are in LA. I mean, there's just a huge concentration of them, and the opportunities to get jobs as writers or get jobs as an actor or actress, a lot of the entertainment industry that's conducive to being a stand-up comic, and making money off of it is in LA. There are people that do start in LA. And that is like the worst thing that you can possibly do, because the audiences are terrible. Nobody actually goes out to go see stand-up comedy. Like, really, it's like if you're in DC or if you're in Atlanta, people actually go to see stand-up comedy. Like, they actually go see shows. They actually go see even open mics. In LA, nobody goes to see stand-up comedy, it feels like. You know, there are shows I've seen, like, you know, star comedians perform in coffee houses in front of five people. And these are people that are like, we'd all know. I remember, you know, performing at a coffee house, and, you know, Maria Bamford, who's a big kind of figure. I mean, you know, she would go out and go on tour and charge $50 a head at, you know, the, you know, Chuckle Hut and, you know, Anytown America. In LA, it's like, you know, there isn't that level of interest in people going to see stand-up comedy. So the level of talent is really high, and there's a relative apathy when it comes to stand-up comedy. And it's not like total apathy, but there's a stronger apathy for stand-up comedy and less of an interest than if you're in Atlanta or another city where you can actually go in front of real crowds of civilians. In LA, you're playing to your peers, and that makes it very tough if you're new and you don't know what you're doing to really get to get entrenched. And I kind of found that out the hard way in some respects when I was doing the study.
It reminds me of I remember thinking about this, how in the sociology business, part of the challenge is trying to appeal to an audience that is quite certain that they could do a better job than you're doing right now. Anytime you're saying that. I imagine it's the same thing doing LA comedy.
Yeah, is there a reviewer number two problem with going to a club where everyone in the audience is a comic?
All the empty chairs. All the empty chairs are reviewer number two. All the comics are reviewer number two. Basically, your friends are the only people that aren't reviewer number two. So...
Okay, so Pat, I just want to wrap my head around this. So this was an ethnography, but like more than that, like you were, it was like participant observation. So you were putting yourself out right? You know, doing stand up.
I had never done stand up comedy before this study, no inclination to do it whatsoever, but I kind of had to do it in order to, you know, gain access and kind of get a sense of like the tacit knowledge that's involved in this sort of exercise.
Yeah. So I have two follow ups on that. Okay. So what was the most glorious non-academic moment for you, like up on that stage where you were like, I'm victorious. Right. And then the second is, did it in any way actually help, right, in the academic, like this, like production of knowledge process, or did it actually maybe hurt it a little bit, made you think that you've gone the wrong route?
Certainly, I did not go the wrong route. I should not be on any stage. I shouldn't be talking through any microphones. I was the way in which I think of it is that the best way to describe my ability in stand-up comedy is that I'm better at stand-up comedy than Louis Quaquant is as an amateur boxer. That's like the only standard that I can really say. There were a couple of times in which, you know, when you have a joke that hits, that is something that's really edifying. I mean, when you have something that you work on and you actually get that first bit of laughter and from the hardened comics and you get accepted into social circles and stuff like that. I mean, by no means do I consider myself a comic at all, but I think that one of those things that, you know, there is a certain thing where there's kind of small incremental things where there wasn't like a thing where I like laid down a joke at this one open mic and you know, everybody stood up and carried them away on their shoulders like Rudy. But I mean, they're it's just kind of the small things. And I mean, one of the things that was actually really interesting about my study, especially given the fact of like where I was and what time I did it, was that the people that I started out with that were starting out as being new open micers are starting to kind of develop their careers and be known figures. And there are people that are really talented that didn't do that, but it was like actually getting to see really super talented people do their thing is like, that was kind of the best part of doing this study, was seeing people that are at the top of their game developing in kind of a sea of, I mean, Gabe's gone to a couple of these stand-up comedy shows. It's like, you see some utter garbage.
I can attest to that.
Yeah. And seeing like kind of people develop that are really, really talented and seeing their process. That is the thing that I think was really kind of the, especially, I'm not like a huge stand-up comedy fan or anything like that. I didn't go into it as like a stand-up comedy fan. I mean, that was the thing that was just really cool, seeing people develop and do their thing. I mean, my ability as a stand-up comic, I think it made me a little bit hardened so that I could teach undergraduates better. But I would not recommend that as a way to improve your pedagogy, is, you know, going out to open mics and, you know.
Is it harder to write a paper or develop a 30-minute bit?
Well, I've written papers and I haven't done a 30-minute bit. I don't have a 30. I mean, it's relatively – I think the process is kind of the same, right? Where, you know, there is – yeah, when we read the papers in journals and we watch the shows, you know, we watch people's like Comedy Central specials and stuff like that, you see the finished product. You don't get a sense of the process. And I think that there is a sort of longstanding, it's more public when it comes to people developing their 30s. But I think that, you know, there's a very similar sort of thing of frustration and workshopping and things like that, that kind of play out. I think that doing a good 30 is incredibly, incredibly tough. It takes people like 10 or 12 years to really make a really solid 30 minutes. And that's why you have a lot of people that do their first 30 when they're asked to do their next 30, like, and they only have 2 years to do it or only have a year to do it. I mean, that's why you have the sophomore slump so hard. I mean, and that's becoming really apparent with, you know, Netflix basically just bombarding everybody with like just churned out stand-up comedy specials that are just like one after another after another. Yeah, doing the 30 is just incredibly, incredibly difficult. That's really good, and you can be really successful with
it. How many minutes do you have? I know in character you have like what, 12 minutes?
I do stand up as alter ego sometimes, just to spice it up a little bit. I would say probably I could do 15. I probably have about 15, but I mean, if you took my 15 on the road as me to have me as like a feature, I would not be a good feature, I don't think. It's very difficult to do, you know, stand-up comedy at a high level. I mean, it takes a lot of work. I mean, people will hit 25 open mics a week for a number like 3-4 years in order to just get that first solid 10-15 minutes. I mean, even to get like a Conan quality set that's only 5.
Yeah, and just to give a sense of like what kind of venues these are at, I've seen Pat do his set 2 or 3 times, and all those times it was at a record store where they just kind of push some of the bins to the side and set up folding chairs.
Yeah, there's a lot of really like, I mean, it's incredibly, it's almost like punk rock in a way how they do these kind of venues, because there are the established clubs. And there was kind of a very sort of stagnant period with the club. So, by the clubs like Comedy Store, the Improv, and the Laugh Factory. And the Comedy Store has actually kind of had a resurgence as of late by kind of adopting more of these sort of tactics of having the comics produce their own shows. But a lot of the shows in LA are very much in like improvised like settings, like backyards. There was a lot of backyard shows, shows in adult bookstores. There's one show called The Pleasure Chest at this place called The Pleasure Chest that gets it's a great show. The two best examples of that, there was a show called Holy Fuck that was in downtown LA. That would get like, they'd have to get security to keep people out. And this was in a time where people weren't going out to see comedy very often. And they would fill a 300 seat, movie theater like that. But my favorite one is, and I think the one that people best know is that there was a theater, and this is kind of noteworthy because it's closing in a month, in the back of a place called Meltdown Comics. It's a comic book store in LA. And that's where they produced the podcast, The Nerdist. Kamel Nanjiani and Jonah Ray started a show in the back of Meltdown Comics called Comedy Meltdown that was, it was gangbusters. I mean, they turned it into a Comedy Central show, series. There a lot of the venues that are really, where this stuff happens are places that you would not expect. I mean, it's almost like comedy gets foisted on you. It like just shows up in this kind of guerrilla way, like you're sipping coffee and it's just like, oh yeah, now there's a bunch of stand-up comics. I mean, it's kind of crazy in that sort of way, how like kind of just, and this isn't every city. I mean, if you're in a major city in LA, if you're in a major city in the United States, a lot of the stand-up comedy in New York and Washington, D.C., Atlanta, they all kind of unfold in that certain, in that type of way. So, I mean, that's kind of alternative comedy, as they call it.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask, I mean, we've been talking about the material from your last special, but I wanted to talk about the stuff that you're still kind of workshopping. So can you tell us about the joke theft paper that you're, it's going through the pipe. And hopefully should be out relatively soon, but it's still in the pipe.
It's under review, so it's like, it's what should we title it as? Like, the title of it. No, I'm currently one of the paper that I'm working on right now is kind of on the uneven enforcement of norms concerning joke theft. And Yeah, it's fascinating because it is kind of loosely coupled to, I mean, there's verbatim thefts, right? But it's loosely coupled to how similar the joke is to another person's joke. And it more reflects kind of how you're seen as a member of the community, right? If you're an authentic comic, like if you're a comics comic. So it's not like your jokes are authentic or you're telling these like heart-wrenching stories about your, you know, trips to rehab or, you know, various life traumas. I mean, it's like kind of based around if you're understood as being a member of the comedy community. So it becomes more attached, like joke theft becomes more attached to things like, do you stay within your allotted time? Do you treat other comics with respect? Are you part of the, even if you're a star, do you still go out and perform and grind and things like that? And also if you're a hack. I mean, so it that sort of thing where there are people that will steal jokes like outright, but you know, there's other people like Dane Cook who got labeled like a joke thief. And really, if you look at kind of the formal quote unquote theft, I mean, it's a borderline case. And I saw a number of cases where comics will acknowledge, you know, cases that are more severe and more egregious and kind of explain them away or kind of funnel them into the world of gossip, and or even just say, you know, oh, this isn't a theft because this guy isn't a writer, he's a performer, and you know, he or she is making it their own, so it's not really, so it's kind of this weird sort of uneven application of this kind of normative violation. And that's the paper that I've been kind of wrestling with. It's my MA paper. So it's about a million years old at this point, it feels like. But that's the kind of the paper that I've been really kind of devoting a lot of my attention to right now.
What makes a hack a hack?
A hack is like kind of a very subjective term. But I think it's usually what stand-up comics, they kind of associate it with taking the easy route, right? Getting the easy laugh or sticking to certain hackneyed premises, right? You know, hack is short for, you know, I think probably short for hackneyed. That you stick to basically hackneyed premises where it's like, dating is hard in LA, right? And it's like, you don't go beyond the base of it. A lot of the kind of, you know, a lot of the assignment of how quality somebody is as a stand-up comic is, you know, you'll even have stand-up comics that'll say, hey, look, funny is funny. And part of it is, you know, how much effort do you go into to not take the easy laugh, but take the kind of circuitous route to taking, you know, not getting that easy laugh, but get a laugh regardless. I mean, it's kind of a show of your craft expertise that you can, you know, take a trite topic, right, and get a different take on that sort of thing, or take a topic that is completely random and nonsensical and get a, you know, a good take on that, or even take a topic that is something that is traumatic and being able to get a you know, good laugh on that. You know, like Lori Kilmartin, who's a stand-up comic, had a special called 45 Jokes About My Dead Dad, right? And it's absolutely hilarious. And it's, you know, very much shows like, you know, kind of the things that are not hacky. I mean, people will talk about hackiness as like just being something where it's like you just go for the same stuff or you go for the easy route, you know. So that's kind of but it's completely subjective.
It's kind of like the last installment, like the third installment on Netflix of Chappelle, like stand-up, where he talks about having a goldfish, where he has a goldfish bowl where he has just random words and he just picks one out and he's like, and I can tell a joke about it. And that's brilliant, right? Are there many people that you think can do that? Like you can, I mean, I'm not saying that Dave Chappelle can, but I'm kind of convinced that he can, but
I mean, there's a lot of when the sausage is being made, he does go up on stage and ramble quite a bit, but he's Dave Chappelle, so he can ramble in a very sort of entertaining way. That's not just, you know, him taking up space, but you know, there's a lot of, you know, a really seasoned, I mean, you know, when people talk about like how people take down hecklers and things like that, a lot of comics that are good seasoned stand-up comics kind of know how to construct jokes or know how to just do what they need to do in a way where you can give them a certain topic and they can craft something that is a really great joke, you know, because they're kind of, they're familiar with kind of how to do the process, right? And how to kind of construct something that turns out, but there's a lot of work involved. I mean, obviously there's a lot of work that gets into it, but I mean, seeing a lot of people, you know, react to stuff on stage or react to certain stimuli, or there was even a show called Set List where they would just basically have a wheel and they would spin the wheel and say, okay, do 2 minutes on this particular topic. I mean, there's a lot of comics that can definitely, you know, hone in and be able to do that sort of thing. But it's almost like, in a way, when, you know, Howard Becker talks about jazz improvisation, right? You know, where it's like, you know, the standards well enough, you know, kind of the basic pieces well enough, the conventions well enough, that if, you know, something comes around and somebody, you know, heckles you or somebody says, hey, do a joke about this particular thing, you know, the conventions well enough that you can kind of really do something super solid and then maybe have your small little twing on it where through polish or, you know, just being supremely talented and having a good point of view.
Well, one last question from me. Does the cream rise to the top in this business?
not necessarily.
To what degree?
I mean, you know, there is, that's a very tough question. I mean, because it is, I mean, it's a cultural production industry, right? There is a, it's stochastic, right? There is a element where there are certain people that are really quite talented that remain in obscurity and are kind of comics, but nobody kind of really knows them outside of a small group of people that either see them or are fans of them or fellow comics. And there's other people that get very successful and, you know, the comics kind of throw up their hands and say, why is this person, you know, successful? And they, and, you know, some of that stuff invites, like, you know, the joke theft sort of accusations, right? You know, why is Dane Cook successful? I think he's a hack, you know, and why isn't, you know, Eddie Pepitone the biggest comic in the world, right? So, I mean, there is a sort of thing where I personally, you know, what I see is that there's a lot of people that are talented that get their opportunities, right? But I think that when it comes to the cream rising to the top, right, it's a cultural production industry, and it is, you know, it's stochastic. I mean, there are tons of things that prevent really talented people from rising to the top. You know, there's tons of reasons why people do rise to the top that people feel are not necessarily successful. And I mean, it's really tough to make that sort of judgment, right? But yeah.
So when you go on stage, do you use your real name or a pseudonym?
Okay, so I did use my real name, and for better or for worse, because I have told so many bad jokes that I think maybe, you know, and not like bad, like topic wise. I mean, these are like legitimately not funny. Like, they're not problematic. They're just not funny because I tend to work very clean. But I did perform for a short time. I'd mentioned this before, in alter ego, because I don't find myself to be particularly interesting. And there's a lot of guys that look like me in stand-up comedy in LA, right? Guys with, like, you know, black plastic frame glasses and beards and stuff like that. So I started doing alter egos on stage, which I went under the name Butt Rock Brett for a while, who was the imagine if Limp Bizkit was an actual sentient person who did stand-up comedy. That was him. And I had, like, a wig and all that sort of thing. And then I would go on for a short time as your dad. And I would go on and basically do stand-up comedy as everyone's disapproving dad that was mad that they were, like, that they weren't in law school like they promised their parents, you know, and that they're – yeah. So, I mean, I've kind of operated around there under my own name. And no, there aren't any clips of me doing comedy on YouTube because I did not – yeah, I don't think it was very good. So, you
know. There's hundreds of hours of you doing your podcast, which is under your own name.
And it's also, you know, edited and you know, different. I mean, it's a different medium, right? My undergraduate advisor is Tim Dowd. And I remember meeting with Tim after I finished my PhD very recently. And he just looked at me and he was just like, if somebody told me that you were doing this project back in like 2006 when you graduated from undergrad, I wouldn't have believed it. You know, so it's one of those sorts of things where I'm not naturally, that's not part of my natural sort of personality to kind of do this sort of thing. So I don't know. I don't think that it didn't lend me well to doing stand-up comedy well, I think. But
yeah, this pretextual issue with the joke theft is endlessly fascinating to me. And you know, it's there's other areas in social life where you see somebody violates a norm or is seen to be an obtuse or mean or selfish or whatever person. And so you see people make a pretextual accusation, which may or may not have some truth to it, but that's not the real reason they're making the accusation. It's just that you can't, there's a weird way in which the norm is the norm, but you can't accuse someone of violating the norm. You have to accuse them of something else as a way to punish them for violating the norm.
Yeah, or the behavior invites that sort of thing. So one example that I kind of drew an analogy with the joke theft thing is witchcraft accusations, right? When you don't have a sort of, you know, if you don't have like an oracle, right, that tells you that dark magic has been cast, like, you know, when Evans Pritchard was talking about the Zande people, right? A lot of cases, there is the identification of witches is highly speculative. And if you look at, you know, for example, the Salem witch trials, the first three people accused of being witches, you know, they possessed these sort of marginal positions within the community. I mean, you had Tituba, who was a you know, an enslaved woman, right? You had Sarah Good, who was a beggar who didn't work and was a, you know, and that goes against kind of these puritanical principles of industriousness. And then Sarah Osborne, who didn't go to church and was cohabiting with a guy before they got married, right? And these kind of, these sort of transgressions kind of invite the accusation or invite the sort of, you know, assigning this particular norm violation of witchcraft to these three particular individuals who have these sort of previous behaviors and are also understood as being peripheral members of the community or people that are considered to be kind of non-members of the community because they're, you know, not they're beggars or something like that. So, and there's, you know, other sorts of things, you know, kind of academic plagiarism and, you know, other sort of analogies. Even, you know, I kind of see that there's some parallels with the, you know, questionable research practices in social psych, right? Where there are people that make up studies. You have your Michael LaCours that just make stuff up, right? But, you know, there is that sort of, you know, p-hacking stuff is kind of a prevalent sort of practice, but you have the selection of particular individuals, you know, like Amy Cuddy and stuff like that, that get accused of these sort of norm violations. And it's, you know, it can be pretextual. It could also be the fact that, you know, you can't, you know, label somebody as being a transgressor for being doing pop psychology, right? So you can find, you know, kind of hone in on this as a pretext, or it's something that invites people to say, oh, there has to be some sort of explanation why, or some sort of sign as to why that is the case.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.